Native American Student and Community Center in Portland. The Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium will feature artist talks and presentations by Native artists, a panel discussion, a community meal, an artist marketplace, and more. Again, that's the Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium on Saturday, October 26th from noon to 6 p.m. at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center, 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is having our annual book and record sale on November 23, 2019 to raise funds with support from the Willamette Week Give Guide. The sale will be located at Lagunitas Portland Community Room at 237 Northeast Broadway from 12 p.m. until 9 p.m. From classic books to coffee table books to cookbooks, treasures will be waiting for your discovery and just in time for the holidays. Enjoy community music, activities, and a live broadcast from KBOO at the event. Proceeds from the sales will support the station's operations. Right now, KBOO is accepting used books and records in good condition. Now through Friday, November 15th, listeners, members, and supporters can drop off donations during business hours at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. After hours, appointments can be made available. For more information, please call 503-231-8032 or go online to kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, bacteria in Portland's water supply threatens those with compromised immunity.
The United Auto Workers strike against GM has ended after 40 days.
And in other news, the United Nations Sunday Climate Conference on Climate Justice will take place this weekend.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 25th, 2019. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
And I'm Althea Billings. Portland residents with weakened immune systems should talk to their doctors before drinking city tap water. That's according to the city's Water Bureau, who found cryptosporidium in water sample tests from the Bull Run watershed on Tuesday. Drinking from the tap should be safe for most people. However, there is a small risk for diarrhea, vomiting, and other stomach problems. People with strong immune systems should recover without medical treatment. For people with weakened immune systems, like those with AIDS, cancer, or other immune conditions, drinking the water could result in life-threatening gastrointestinal illness. Other communities in the Bull Run watershed should also be warned of the risks, including Sandy, Tualatin, and Gresham. Portland is under state and federal orders to start filtering water, and it has plans to build a filtration system by 2027 for a cost of $850 million.
Workers gathered today at the Montevilla Burgerville location to strike, demanding health benefits, higher wages, and better scheduling practices. Union rep Sandra Decker explains one of their primary complaints.
The workers have unionized, and they're trying to get a good deal from the owners of Burgerville, and so far that hasn't happened. Besides higher pay, one of the main issues is they often, or always, get their schedule just about 3 days before the week starts, and they don't know if they have 10 hours or 20 hours, and that's hard to pay the rent.
The strike caps off the week of action planned by the Burgerville Union, which also included an Occupy Burgerville campout outside the company's headquarters in Vancouver, Washington on Thursday. The strike will continue on Saturday at the Burgerville location on Southeast Hawthorne.
40 days after announcing the strike, United Auto Workers have reached an agreement with General Motors and ended their strike. The new contract brings workers hired after 2007 up to the same wage as older workers over 4 years, and it keeps health benefits. GM also agreed to give temporary workers paid time off and will allow them to apply for open full-time jobs after 3 years as a temp. Last month, the union's nearly 50,000 employees walked out after voting for work stoppages. The strike would go on to become the longest at GM for decades, and the effects were felt around the country, not just at the automaker. Regional suppliers across the country who feed GM's auto construction also felt the pressure when the plants were down. Union Vice President Terry Dietz told NPR that the union was proud of the workers. Quote, "Their sacrifice and courageous stand address the two-tier wages structure and permanent temporary worker classification that has plagued working-class Americans."
This Sunday, the First Unitarian Church will be hosting the United Nations Sunday, a conference on climate justice. One of the panelists, Shannon McClure, sat down with KBOO's Althea Billings to tell us more about the event.
Hi, I'm Shannon McClure. I work with the Regional Arts and Culture Council, and I'm also an educator. I've been a teacher and a principal, an assistant principal in Portland Public Schools for years.
So I understand you are a part of a climate justice conference event this weekend. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so there's a United Nations event that's happening on Sunday at the Unitarian Church downtown. And at 12:30, everybody's meeting up for some light refreshments. And then after that, the program begins around 1 o'clock, where there's a panel of folks interested in climate justice, all with a little bit different perspectives around climate justice. And from there, we're having a conversation and holding space for public conversation.
Cool. And so what would you say your perspective on climate justice is?
My perspective, my background's really in racial justice. And so for me, I'm really interested in looking particularly at the fact that climate change really has a disproportionate impact on communities of color, and also just acknowledging that we have a lot of activists in our communities of color that aren't necessarily able to be as visible or sometimes aren't as recognized as their white counterparts.
Right. So I also understand that you were there during the arrest at the climate strike. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I was there on September 20th was when students walked out of school. As we were crossing the bridge, many students were along the railing and actually adults, many adults were along the railing too, getting chants started and that sort of thing. And toward the end of the march, there was a young black man that was a high school student, so a boy, who was specifically, in my perspective, targeted by police, and forcefully arrested for doing essentially the same thing that everyone was doing that day on the bridge.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, the climate strike was sort of this seminal moment in youth activism, especially around climate change. But then, you know, in Portland, we did have that forceful arrest that I think maybe tainted the memory, I think, for some people.
Yeah, and it, you know, just being there as an educator and a parent of a 16-year-old son, and also a person of color, it was something that I really, you know, I tried to intervene and asked police at that point to, you know, help by turning the student to me so that I could reunite them with their family. And it was scary to see police enacting such violence on youth. So that was definitely a moment too where I was aware that not all students are able to have the same experience in demonstrating when it comes to climate justice.
Right. There is a difference about the impact that can have. So for this event this weekend, what are you hoping people will get out of it?
There are folks speaking on a lot of different perspectives around climate change. My hope is that folks are able to see beyond the Greta Thunberg activism and really see that there's activism happening at a grassroots level in Portland, and also globally by young black and indigenous folks. So it makes me think of Flint, Michigan, and if you don't already, you should follow Lil Miss Flint, who has just raised over $130,000 for water filtration systems for Flint, Michigan, and she's 12 years old. So for me, I really think about youth being at the forefront of leading not just the justice movement, but really actionable solutions. And my hope is that by convening, we're able to bring youth and elders and everyone in between together to be strategic and really see what we can do together.
So as an educator, as an adult, what do you think, you know, ideally is the role of adults in supporting this movement that is in large part driven by youth and youth of color?
Mm-hmm. I think that there are lots of opportunities to put your money where your mouth is, you know. So I think when we say that climate justice and is something that's important, I think that we really need to look to see where we can invest. Flint, Michigan, and the water filtration system is a good example of not just solving a water problem, but also solving an issue of one-use plastics that have been overused, you know, because of the water crisis in Flint. And so all of that's possible because folks have been donating money to that cause. So I think that that's a big commitment that folks need to invest in climate justice.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to impart to our listeners today? Anything we haven't covered?
I would just say to youth that might be listening right now, all ears are open and all eyes are on you. And that is a big responsibility. And also just know that there are folks in community that are here to support you. It's big work, and that can take an emotional toll as well. So reach out to your school counselors if you need support. And I think that's it. Yeah.
That's great. And tell me one more time about that event that's this weekend.
So the event this weekend is the United Nations Sunday, which is held by the First Unitarian Church. They're located in downtown Portland at 1011 Southwest 12th. And the event begins at 12:30 and ends around 3.
Awesome. Well, Shannon, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings. Portland's Lompoc Brewing announced yesterday it will be closing after 23 years in business. Lompoc's demise is the most recent in a string of brewery closures that have affected Portland over the last several years. The closure includes the brewery and its two North Williams pubs, Fifth Quadrant and Sidebar. Lompoc owner Jerry Fetcher will continue to own and operate Oaks Bottom Public House in Southeast Portland's Westmoreland neighborhood. The pub will serve Lompoc beer until it's gone. The last day of business for the closing establishments will be next Tuesday. Fetcher will be having a garage sale Saturday, November 2nd at the Sidebar location. Merchandise will be for sale, including vintage bottles and the remaining beer. Other recent Portland brewery casualties include Bridgeport Brewing, Alameda Brewing, Burnside Brewing, and Portland Brewing Tap Room and Restaurant.
Representative Tim Ryan drops out of the race, and Senator Amy Klobuchar qualifies for the next debate. Also, the League of United Latin American Citizens held a town hall in Des Moines last night.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
After 7 long months of hard work, I'll be returning home to my family and friends and community in Ohio to run for re-election for my congressional seat. I got into this race in April to really give voice to the forgotten people of our country.
Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio dropped out of the Democratic presidential primary yesterday, bringing the total number of candidates to 18. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, on the other hand, qualified for next month's Democratic primary debate in Georgia yesterday, after a Quinnipiac University national poll put her at 3%. She's positioned herself as a moderate Democrat who can bring in people who voted for President Donald Trump.
If you feel stuck in the middle of the extremes in our politics and you are tired of the noise and the nonsense, you've got a home with me.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren leads in the Quinnipiac poll with 30% over former Vice President Joe Biden's 27%. A very different CNN poll Wednesday, though, had Biden at 35%, with Warren and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders close to each other but far behind Biden at 19% and 16%. Contrary to long-held and bipartisan norms, Republican lawmakers stormed the closed-door session where Laura Cooper, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Ukraine, was about to testify earlier this week, delaying the deposition that was part of the president's impeachment inquiry. Meanwhile, on the ground in Iowa, LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, and Newsmax TV planned a four-candidate presidential town hall, which happened last night. Here's LULAC CEO Cindy Benavides.
When we planned the town hall, it was really to ensure that the candidates were speaking directly to our community, that they were energizing them, and that they were, in essence, saying, you are a part of America when we are getting such a negative message from the White House.
There were all kinds of questions, from reproductive rights to diversity to the impeachment inquiry to immigration reform. LULAC moderators and audience questioners got the candidates to go beyond their usual talking points, such as when Bernie Sanders advocated for workers' rights for everyone, a typical Sanders line, but with a focus on undocumented immigrants.
When you're undocumented, you can't stand up and say, hey, employer, you're not paying me the minimum wage. You don't like it, we're going to deport you. So what we have got to do now is make sure that all workers have legal protection in this country, whether they are documented or undocumented. And that's important for everybody, not just the undocumented.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of 39. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 55. Today in history, on this date in 1945, Taiwan became independent of Japanese colonial rule. The quote of the day is from Taiwanese director Ang Lee. You can't move forward without changing, and that's why I try to stay open to new perspectives. I want to keep learning. If there's one thing I've learned, it's that you can never learn enough.
When competition became stiff, Michael Kovach switched from drilling oil in western Pennsylvania to raising sustainably grass-fed beef on his family farm. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 15 years ago, Michael Kovach was drilling oil and gas wells in western Pennsylvania. But the boom in shale oil production made it difficult for his small company to compete. So we switched to farming. These days, you'll find him raising grass-fed beef. At his family's Walnut Hill farm, cattle and sheep graze in long grass, and pigs forage in a wooded area. Kovach carefully manages the livestock to prevent overgrazing and to work more carbon into the soil.
Building organic matter into the soil is really a great way to retain a lot of the excess water that we've seen over the last few years, especially.
Kovach encourages other farmers to adopt similar strategies. His focus on climate change may seem surprising given his former career, but he says there are parallels.
I got into oil and gas in the day when that was seen as the best bridge to the next big thing. And it was way cleaner than continuing to tear the tops off of mountains for coal.
He says it was not a perfect solution, but a step in the right direction.
Likewise today, I feel like I'm doing my bit to make food better, make soil better, make animal welfare better, all those things.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The ramp from US 30 to I-405 southbound will be closing tonight for 11 days while the Oregon Department of Transportation repairs and replaces bridge joints on the ramp. The full closure lasts from Friday, October 25th at 8 p.m. until November 4th at 10 a.m. During the closure, the Fremont Bridge and I-405 will remain open and detour signs will be in place. However, drivers should expect delays, especially during heavy commute hours.
There are thousands of different types of blue-green algae, but only a few produce harmful toxins. The trouble is you can't tell which ones are safe and which ones aren't. With more on the story, it's Current Cast.
It can be hard to tell the good guys from the bad. On this Current Cast. Blue-green algae aren't all bad. After all, there are about 6,000 different species.
There are probably only 100 or so that are known to make toxins and that would be considered harmful.
That's Greg Boyer of the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry. He says the organisms are some of the oldest and most diverse on the planet. They thrive in sun, warmth, and calm waters. But add to that too many nutrients, and they can bloom out of control. Some blooms make toxins that can be harmful if ingested, touched, or even inhaled. But others do not. The trouble is, you can't tell which is which without a toxicity test. So play it safe. If you see an algal bloom, stay away. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environment Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
DACA recipients will be joined tomorrow by community leaders and allies on a journey to Washington, D.C. as they begin the Home is Here March. Andrea Sears has more on the story.
On Saturday, undocumented immigrants who arrived in the United States as children will be joined by community leaders and allies as they begin a 230-mile Home is Here march to Washington, D.C. The march is being timed to arrive in the nation's capital on the day the Supreme Court hears arguments in a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's termination of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. The program was instituted in 2012 and allows immigrants who were 16 or younger when they were brought to the United States to go to school and to work without fear of deportation. Antonio Alarcón is a plaintiff in the case. He points out that for many DACA recipients, this country has been their home since they were very young.
It's the place that we grew up, the place that we have friends, the place where we work.
There are approximately 700,000 people enrolled in DACA. The Supreme Court is expected to issue a ruling by June of next year. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit argue that the Trump administration's action to terminate the DACA program is arbitrary and capricious, and that President Barack Obama had the authority to authorize the program.
This is not the first time that a president used their executive power to give protection to folks, so there shouldn't be any legal concerns in terms of the validity of the DACA program.
He says lower federal courts have ruled the termination of DACA is unlawful and have issued injunctions allowing DACA recipients to renew their status. Alarcón notes that other courts are expected to rule soon on more immigration issues, including the Trump administration's termination of temporary protected status for some 300,000 immigrants.
This is just the beginning, and regardless what happens at the Supreme Court, we will continue to fight for justice for the 11 million undocumented folks.
For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
An aquifer in the arid Taos Valley of northern New Mexico is being threatened by a settlement that will mine the deep layers of the aquifer, possibly disrupting the land and causing dire consequences to the Rio Grande Corridor. An aquifer is a body of permeable rock that can contain or transmit groundwater, making it extremely valuable to locations with little rainfall. Guardians of Taos Water, a collective in the Taos Valley, is dedicated to the protection and restoration of water in the area. Hydrogeological testing in the region has shown water at this depth to be highly alkaline and unfit for consumption, and drilling into the aquifer could drastically disrupt the health of the ecosystem and overall water quality in the area. Drilling through the shallow aquifer into the deep aquifer could create a cascading well scenario, with a potential risk of draining the shallow aquifer completely and causing domestic wells to disappear. From a global perspective, NASA has found that 21 of the world's 37 aquifers have passed the sustainable tipping point, raising the alarm for areas that struggle with an already depleting freshwater supply.
The Supreme Court of Canada will hear an appeal next spring on a case in which a Washington State man went hunting illegally on what he believes to be his tribal homeland, in a case that has implications for other Canadian First Nations. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with the National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Supreme Court of Canada will hear an appeal next spring in a decade-long tribal sovereignty case. As Emily Schwing reports, the announcement comes a decade after a Washington state man went hunting illegally for elk on what he believes is his traditional homeland.
In 2009, Rick Desitel intentionally hunted illegally in Canada. He believes it's his right to hunt in southern British Columbia because he's a descendant of the Sinaixt, a tribe that originated there. His attorney, Mark Underhill, says his case has implications for other Canadian First Nations.
I know many of them are struggling with a myriad of issues cross-border, whether it be healthcare or just crossing the border itself, you name it, when they've got, you know, members of a First Nation who are citizens in two different countries.
British Columbia's provincial government has appealed the case twice since 2017. That's when a judge acquitted Rick Desitel of illegal hunting charges. Mark Underhill says he's not surprised to see the case go all the way to Canada's highest court.
You know, we did get three very strong judgments from the lower courts that might have suggested we wouldn't end up in the Supreme Court of Canada. But having said that, you know, the underlying issues are very important.
After the last surviving Canadian Sinaixt member passed away more than 60 years ago, Canada's federal government issued an official extinction declaration for the tribe. But the tribe still has federal recognition in the United States. Thousands of Sinaixt descendants live on the Colville Reservation in north-central Washington state. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will keep his job after Canada's recent election. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the country's Indigenous leaders are giving the government a cautious welcome.
In the last election in 2015, Justin Trudeau's Liberals won a majority. In that election, Indigenous voters turned out in record numbers to cast their ballots. Some reserves even ran out of ballot forms. But during this election campaign, Indigenous issues were all but ignored by the party leaders. Cindy Blackstock is with the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. She says there are many outstanding Indigenous issues that need to be addressed.
What I want is a comprehensive plan on how to address the inequalities that First Nations, Métis and Inuit peoples experience and some of the other issues regarding recognition of rights that have been outstanding for years.
A more optimistic tone was coming from Perry Bellegarde, the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. He praised the Trudeau government for its accomplishments so far.
The Liberal government that was in power has done more for First Nations people than any government in the last 30, 40 years. You just look at and what happened in terms of Bill C-91 on languages, Bill C-92 on child welfare, the $21.4 billion over seven fiscal years.
Bellegarde, too, acknowledged that much more work needs to be done, saying that progress does not mean parity. He said he wants to see continued investment in education and housing and an end to boil water advisories on reserves and finding ways to implement the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Fawn Sharp, the leader of the Quinault Indian Nation, was elected Thursday as president of the National Congress of American Indians. Her top priority is to advance a sovereignty agenda for member tribes of NCAI.
I think I have a very clear message when I take leadership roles that sovereignty is just not a passive thing. It's something that we must put into action, and I'm ready to put every bit of the brain trust into action to seize the future that we all deserve and that our children and those generations yet to be born deserve.
Sharp and other executive board members were sworn in Friday at NCAI's annual convention in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 25th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
And I'm Althea Billings. Counterspin coming up next.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court won't rule until spring on the cases it recently took up involving employment discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. But that doesn't mean we have to wait until then to assess the state of fairness for LGBTQ people in U.S. society. Just as abortion can be out of reach, even with Roe v. Wade in place, the gap between what the law says a person merits and the harms and hardships they actually experience can be cavernous. It doesn't mean ignoring the legal front, just placing it within a more complex picture. We'll talk about that with writer and organizer Dorothy Benz. Also on the show, you have to hand it to Time magazine. Their explainer on the recent anti-austerity protest in Ecuador boils it down to what they forthrightly label, quote, the one thing to say about it at a dinner party, close quote. The answer that the anti-democratic infliction of suffering on the poor to benefit the wealthy through institutions like the IMF is still gospel, but be aware, sometimes the peons don't go for it, is the same as found in other elite media, just in fewer words. We'll talk about coverage of Ecuador with Joe Emmersberger, writer for a number of outlets, including Fair.org. That's coming up, and we'll get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. In early October, the Supreme Court took up three related cases involving the rights of LGBTQ people deemed significant, blockbuster, or momentous in the press. Well, what you got from corporate media coverage was a pretty finely grained analysis of the legal stance.